You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Boston, Massachusetts, from February 3rd through February 6th, 2008.
This is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of the Body Pro. One of the oddest presentations at CROI 2008 involved three case reports of HIV transmission to babies when their HIV-infected caregivers pre-chewed the baby's food. I sat down with Dr. Kenneth Dominguez, an epidemiologist at the CDC, and the two physicians who made the report, Dr. Aditya Gaur of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, and Dr. Charles Mitchell of the Leonard M. Miller School of Medicine at the University of Miami. They'll introduce themselves and summarize their findings. Then I'll ask a few questions.
I'm Charles Mitchell, or Charlie Mitchell. I'm a professor of pediatrics at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine.
Thanks. And I'm Aditya Gaur. I'm an assistant professor at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, Department of Infectious Diseases, Memphis.
And I'm Dr. Ken Dominguez. I'm a medical epidemiologist / pediatrician at the Centers for Disease Control in the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention.
Okay. So are you going to be able to summarize the study? When is it being presented today?
We have a poster that's being presented tomorrow between 2 and 4.
Okay. So could you summarize?
Sure. Essentially, what we've uncovered is that there were three cases of children that we believe were HIV infected through the process of eating pre-masticated food from their caregiver. And
could you describe what that means?
Sure. Essentially, it means pre-chew food. And what happens is caregivers sometimes pre-chew food for their infants, for whatever reason, just to make it more palatable for the children.
And how is it delivered? Is it put into a bowl and then spoon-fed, or is it kissed? I was reading that it could be done that way as well.
Right. I think at this point we don't have a lot of information about the actual procedure. I think that's something that we need to investigate further, and something that CDC is very interested in looking into.
Uh-huh. So the procedure, because it turns out that this has been mentioned also for H. pylori risk,
right,
as well?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a number of other organisms that have been implicated to be spread through pre-chewing the food, a lot of case studies. But in terms of the work that CDC has been working on is these three cases of HIV infection. So that's what we're really focusing on in terms of our prevention message.
Uh-huh. So discuss the three case studies.
Yeah, the three case studies, two of the cases occurred in the 1990s in Miami at Dr. Mitchell's institution, University of Miami. And one of the cases was born to an HIV-infected mother. The child was born HIV uninfected, you know, when you do the testing early on, and then the child later seroconverted. And so, the question comes up, why does the child then seroconvert? Why does the child become HIV-infected after they were born HIV uninfected? And after doing a very thorough investigation, you know, asking about all the possible routes of transmission, you know, ask about sexual abuse, needle sticks, blood transfusions, all those other things were negative. And what they did find out was that the caregiver had pre-masticated food for the child. And that was really the only risk factor that they could come up with. The second case in Miami, also occurred in the 90s, was an HIV uninfected child that was born to a mother who was HIV uninfected. So the mother was not infected to begin with. And this child was fed by the pre-masticated food by the great aunt, who was an HIV-infected relative that was unbeknownst to the mother. So occasionally the child would go over to live with or to spend time with the great aunt, and she was pre-masticating
the child. Actually live with the great aunt between the ages of 9 to 14 months with the mother.
Uh-huh. So what's the duration of the feeding? Is it a long duration in general?
In terms of the exposures,
yes,
that we've seen, in two of the cases we know that there is, you know, long duration. In one of them we don't really have a time period. That she just said that she pre-masticated, but she didn't remember the exact time period that it occurred. But we know that in two of the cases, there were sort of factors that would increase the likelihood of transmission. That would be the issue of blood in the mouth of the mother. Two of the caregivers had, you know, there was a report that there was sort of poor oral hygiene and bleeding gums, and so that there was likely to be have been blood mixed with the saliva, which, you know, provides biologic plausibility for transmission through feeding the kids through this method. So, and in the third case, we didn't have information about the oral hygiene in the mother. So that's really important information, because I think that one of the things that we want to emphasize is that it's not necessarily just the act of premasticating, but we think it's very likely that it's the blood in the saliva that's causing, that then gets into the child through, if the child is teething, the oral mucosa is somehow compromised. So either they're teething or they'll have some other sort of inflammation in the mouth, and that allows the virus to get into the child.
But isn't that a rather rare occurrence that someone would have bleeding gums and the child is teething,
right?
You know, and
right,
there's
yeah.
enough of the blood to get into the food that is being premasticated.
It right.
seems.
I think we do think it is a rare situation. The fact that we've had three cases in, you know, basically a decade that have been reported, but there also would be very difficult cases to even think about, because people don't usually ask about this in the first place. So the fact that it did occur, you know, I think we have something to learn from these three cases. They're trying to tell us something, you know, please look into this further, you know, try and describe really what's going on, how prevalent is this behavior in the general population, also in international settings, where oral hygiene may not even be as good as here in the United States. So, and there's a higher level of HIV infection.
Right.
So that coupled with poor oral hygiene and a lot higher HIV rates could mean that this could be a more important issue in the developing world.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about the ethnicity of the patients?
The two in Miami were both black.
But are they from particular countries in Africa? Are they recent immigrants or African
American? One family was African American. The other family was African Caribbean.
Uh-huh. But
they
had
both
born in America?
I don't know about that with regards to the mother of the second case, the African Caribbean. But as far as I know, she had lived in this country for a period of years. The other mother and the child were both born in the United States, in Miami.
Because it's surprising that it wasn't a group of recent immigrants, because it's very prevalent, it seems, this practice of premastication in Asia, in Africa, in West Africa.
That may be a misimpression. Do you want to elaborate on?
Well, I think, when you talk to people anecdotally, a lot of the clinicians really haven't heard too much about this practice. And, if you look in the literature, you really see, like, these case reports of, you know, pre-chewing the food associated with certain pathogens. And so there really isn't a lot of information about this particular behavior. And we've only been able, Aditya uncovered an article maybe you want to mention.
Sure. And I think in reviewing the literature for this, we found a publication in the mid-1980s from Midwest United States, where they asked 60-plus women, majority African American origin, about the practice of premastication, and it was significant. Our report, I think, references the exact number. I don't know if you remember, but it was more than 60% had either premasticated or knew about the practice of premastication. Then about 8 years later, there was a report from Texas which talked about a case series of patients where they saw this practice and related it to some other infectious disease pathogen. So I think that those plus ours, and then there's a FDA CDC survey under analysis right now, indicate that it's not a non-existent practice in the United States despite availability of baby foods and blenders. And I think that's one of our main messages, which is to bring this to the attention of providers in the U.S. so that they could ask the question. Because sometimes what you don't ask, you don't know, and the patients may just assume this is normal.
Since these cases have come up, actually, in our screening clinic, which is the clinic in which babies born to HIV-infected mothers are being tested to see if they themselves, our staff are finding cases where the mother will admit to either knowing about the practice or will admit that they have done the practice and it's not just limited to African Americans.
So I think that that's sort of one of the most important messages, is that we want clients to know that this practice may have, you know, additional risk of transmission, particularly if you're HIV infected, that you really should not be pre-masticating for your child. And because of these three cases that we've uncovered, and I think that it raises the index of suspicion that this is something that that could be happening out there, and that we want folks to be aware of this.
So it's interesting that the cases were very far apart, and that it's just right now you're going to present the abstract at this conference.
Right.
I thought, I guess from the abstract, there were no dates in it, so I thought this just happened.
Right.
So could you talk about that?
The timing of the cases. The first two cases occurred sort of in the mid-90s, and one of the reasons why we waited this long to report those cases is that one other thing I didn't mention earlier was that we're able to do something called phylogenetic studies, where we do sort of a DNA fingerprinting to see whether the viruses that are in the caregiver and the person who transmitted to the child and in the child are the same virus.
Right.
In one of the two Miami cases, there was a match. In the second case, the great aunt had actually passed away before they could get blood samples from her.
5 months before the child was brought to our attention.
Huh. So in that case, there was no way that we could actually get a direct link there, but we did look at the great aunt's sexual partner, the male sexual partner, and there was not a genetic match with the sexual partner. So at that point, we didn't feel comfortable making a big announcement at the time, since we only had one match with one of the cases. And so when Dr. Gower reported this third case in 2004, we then, you know, of course, did a very thorough investigation. And we also contacted the Division of Nutrition at CDC, who then began conducting this national survey. They were in the process of doing this infant feeding practices survey, and they added a question regarding pre-mastication. And so that went on until just last year. That was completed. And we got the result. We're starting to get the preliminary results back, and we're thinking it's happening here in the U.S.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is something, it's real, you know, it's not a figment of our imaginations, and so this is something we felt that needs to get out into the public.
Uh-huh. So what is the CDC plan? I understand the CDC is going to begin a research agenda?
Yes, we're in the process of thinking both on the domestic front and on the international front, sort of what are the next steps in terms of trying to describe both, you know, the practice of pre-mastication in general. I think we need to know more about exactly, you know, who's doing it, why people are doing it, how often they're doing it, what are some of the sort of other conditions that are associated at the time they're doing if they're pre-masticating, you know, how many of them actually have bleeding gums or that sort of, you know, practice. What is their knowledge of the practice? Why are they doing it? All those sorts of questions we have. And also, in the international setting, it's even that much more important because there's so many more infected women out there in the international setting, developing countries, and we think that sort of the conditions are ripe for transmission, you know, if there's poor, you know, oral hygiene, and there's a lot of HIV-infected women, and we know that, you know, there aren't a whole lot of feeding alternatives in terms of canned baby foods or blenders. You know, the likelihood is that they're probably, you know, a lot of them are practicing this sort of practice.
It always strikes me the likelihood that they're practicing this and that we haven't seen cases, or and not that it's very, those countries are well surveyed in terms of how people are getting HIV,
right.
But
I think that probably the fact that generally if you're born to an HIV infected mother, I think people will make the assumption that later on if they seroconvert that, oh, it was a perinatal transmission, just didn't, for some reason didn't show up initially. And so,
since they're mostly breastfeeding,
right? And the other thing is breastfeeding also clouds the picture. So, in that sort of picture, it's really hard to tease out, well, what was it. And then, if you're not even thinking about it in the first place, why would they even, you know, consider that?
Right. We've had, I wouldn't say a large number, but over the years in Miami, as we continue to follow children born to mothers with HIV, we've had a smattering of cases where the child will be tested very early, similar to Dr. Garr's finding in St. Jude's, where the initial testing was negative, and then at approximately 4 or 6 or 7 months of age, will turn out to be positive. And we've just attributed it in the past to just missing, or the viral titer being so low initially that it was not detectable. And now I have to wonder whether this has a role in that type of occurrence.
Uh-huh. So it's interesting, it's just two hospitals that kind of are aware of this, or have you had meetings with people in New York and other states?
Not yet.
Uh-huh. Oh, so this is sort of the initiation of a sort of bringing this to people's attention and making it part of the counseling
right. For
women
right.
After they have a baby. Because now they're just warned not to breastfeed. I mean, it's kind of made very simple.
Right.
But this is a new idea.
It's another little piece of the pie that might be that's likely contributing somehow. And you know, I think people need to be made aware of that.
Uh-huh. So are these children still alive?
Of the two in Miami, one died in 1996, and that was right before the availability of heart therapy. And the other one is now, he is 16, and he is under care.
Uh-huh.
And when he's compliant with his medication, he does fine.
and yours?
Our patient is doing very well.
And
she's engaged in care with us.
How old is she now?
4 years.
So she was born in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. I see.
And I think one of the things we would like to share with the readers is, as part of investigating more about this practice, if especially clinicians, when they note similar instances like what Dr. Mitchell mentioned, where the infection is not easily explainable, then they may want to use the health department resources or contacting the CDC to bring to attention other suspicious cases,
uh-huh.
which could help do a more thorough investigation on a larger number of cases.
That's usually how these cases come to our attention. They'll contact the local state health department and say, we need some help in trying to figure out, could you please send someone to come and help interview the client and ask about all these other potential modes of transmission and do a very thorough job of trying to rule those other things out before you can say it's...
Uh-huh. Is that how you became involved with this?
Yes, that's how we became involved. Both the Division of Surveillance has a group that looks at children with non-identified risk, and the lab also helped out in terms of doing the DNA analysis.
But people know where to contact you at the CDC? Is it a particular department?
Well, right now we haven't released a particular number for that, but we're planning to publish an article. It's going through clearance right now, and hopefully as a part of that we'll be able to give that people a number to contact. We're still getting clearance for that.
About this specific
yes,
thing.
Specific.
But in the meantime?
There's not a number right now.
Okay, so I guess we'll
let
people know.
I can get back to you.
Okay.
And let you know. They haven't released anything yet. So.
And how soon is it that this expected?
Probably the next couple of weeks that we'll be able to submit the article for
great.
Publication, but it's going through the clearance process right now.
Okay. Great.
And the health department infrastructure will always be there. So
yeah, they can always
around the country, it's there.
Their local health department.
Yeah, and so I think an alternative information may be there, but that always stands.
Okay. Okay, great. Well, thank you.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on CROI 2008 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.